Welcome to The Optimized Geek, a podcast full of secret knowledge that will enable you to reboot your life. Ready to improve your health, wealth, partner intimacy, peer group, spirit, career, business, and more? Then buckle up. Here's your host, Stefan Spencer, author, speaker, SEO expert, and a quintessential geek who has been through his own incredible transformation. You wouldn't even recognize him 5 years ago.
We speak to others every day, but how often do we really sway those we speak to? If you want to communicate more effectively, especially when speaking publicly to groups, then this episode number 136 is a must. A speech is a performance, and wouldn't you like to know how to become masterful at these performances? Well, you're about to learn exactly how from Tamsin Webster. Tamsin is an acclaimed keynote speaker, idea whisperer, and change strategist. She combined 20 years in marketing with 13 years as a Weight Watchers leader into a simple structure for understanding, talking about, and creating lasting change. Tamsin, it's great to have you on the show.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, for sure. So I've already interviewed you on Marketing Speak, and we talked to marketers about your frameworks and your different models and so forth. This is a little different of a show because we're going to talk about personal development and speaking and upping your speaking game in that context as like up-leveling yourself. So what would be a good initial story or case example that you want to share of kind of taking it to another level?
Of taking speaking to another level?
Yeah, to even taking your life to another level by using speaking. Like, you have to show up differently in the world if you become a better speaker, better presenter. You hold yourself differently. You kind of take on that persona. And it's, for me at least, all the speaking I've done thousands of speeches over the last two decades. I've become a much better human. And I show up more powerfully and I'm more intentional because of all the speaking that I've done. So I'm just curious if you had an example, either yourself or somebody that's a client or somebody that you know, a friend or a family member who's used speaking in a powerful way.
I'll start with a story of my own, actually. And that's the kind of unusual place where I earned my speaking chops, as it were. And that was as a Weight Watchers leader, which some folks know about me and some folks don't. But I used to be 50 pounds overweight, and I've now kept that off for 20 years and two kids.
Wow.
The kids were the hardest part. So in addition to my full-time job as a marketer, which I was for 20 years, I, as a way to keep myself honest, but also to pay forward something that I ended up being so transformational for me. When Weight Watchers asked if I would become a leader in my free time, all of the free time that I had, I said yes, because I was like, well, I wanted, very practically, I wanted to help keep the meeting open that where I had lost weight. But I also really, as I said, wanted to give back. Now, when you're a Weight Watcher leader, what you're responsible for is not just weighing people in when they come in, but we're given a topic every week. And Weight Watchers is very clear about, these are leaders at meetings, not teachers of a class. And so my job was every week to take this topic. And in the 30 to 45 minutes that I had, my responsibility was really to permanently change as best I could someone's thinking or behavior about that particular topic. So, you know, maybe it was activity, or maybe it was drinking water, or maybe it was positive self-talk, or I mean, it could be all sorts of different things. So I will tell you honestly, I think there's basically about 16 topics and we just rotated them through. But that also became a real challenge and a kind of a creative challenge for me. So by the end of the 13 years, by the time I decided to retire as a Weight Watcher leader, I did the math one time and ended up being about 3,000 presentations. And I say honestly that so much about what I know about speaking, about people, about using speaking to change people, I learned at Weight Watchers. And a huge amount of what I learned there, I applied to my marketing jobs and became a better marketer as a result. And in more recent years, I learned what I learned there to my own speaking, but also the work that I do with other speakers, because it ultimately comes down to, how do you overcome resistance in someone else so that they can find an idea as irresistible as you do. And there was no better training for me than the week in, week out, like, all right, you get up to five chances a week to like figure out the best way to do this. And then you have to start doing it all again with a different topic the next week. And so what I really learned was all sorts of stuff. Not only what were those basic components that were required from an informational standpoint, what did people have to hear in what you say to be convinced? Also learning, for instance, that you can't make anyone agree or do something, but you can only create the space for agreement. So how do you do that as a speaker? Learning what was most powerful for me as a presence in front of other people. I had this mantra that I came to finally, which was that I used to say to myself was check your dignity at the door. Mm-hmm. And what I meant by that was anytime that I tried to be like this authoritative person, it didn't connect with people. And when I was like this dork goofball geeking out on science and behavioral economics, like that's what they loved. They loved that. When I was just like, well, here's a ridiculous thing and here's a thing that happened. And it all just, the more that I didn't think about that, the better I became. And I'd say the final thing that it did for me was just, man, there's no question you can ask me that doesn't throw me. I became extraordinarily comfortable with Q&A as a result of that experience. And it's one of those reasons why even now I make Q&A and interaction with the audience a huge part of my speaking. And increasingly more and more, because that's when I'm most comfortable. That's what I learned from Weight Watchers. So that's a personal example.
I love that.
Yeah. So that's me. That's my Weight Watchers part of it. I could talk about Weight Watchers all day, not because of the plan itself. It's less about that and much more about all those kind of lessons of life and learning and all sorts of other stuff that came along with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So be yourself is kind of one of the key messages here. If you're a dork, then just embrace it.
Yeah. I mean, I've spent a lot of time, as you know, I started my own business about, coming on 2 years ago now. And when I did that, that meant that for the first time, rather than speaking as part of my job, to help other people understand what it was that I was doing in my organization or, as a marketing firm, I mean, now speaking became a third of my job, like a third of my income. Like that's part of my income. Part of my job now is to speak, to be a speaker. And as a result of that, because I felt for my own sake, I wanted to invest in that. I spent a lot of time and a lot of money kind of really diving deep into performance and content and all of that. And I found that I was able to communicate, more keynote areas, two parts of my personality that I thought were important and that I knew worked well from Weight Watchers, which was, smart and interesting. Not because I'm smart. I mean, I very much like to make the audience feel smarter as a result of the talk. And it's part of the reasons why I never shied away in my Weight Watcher meeting of talking to them about some pretty complicated cognitive science and behavioral economics stuff, because they could handle it. And because they knew that I thought they could handle it, they could. And then they walked away just much better armed with and more information. So I always love that kind of stuff. And interesting, that's the thing that I really worked on over the last couple of years to figure out, how do I become a better storyteller? I spent a lot of time studying screenwriting and novel writing and diving into the work of Sean Coyne and Blake Snyder and, oh my gosh, like Cam Miller. How do short form storytellers in other aspects, how do they make the information interesting? So I really kind of got that piece down. But then I kept thinking back to the Weight Watcher meeting, like that kind of speaking was so much fun for me. I loved those Weight Watcher meetings. I mean, and mind you, I was getting paid crap to do it. I wasn't doing it for the money. I had a full-time job, but I was doing it on Sunday mornings and 8 o'clock on Tuesday mornings and 5:30 on Thursday nights. And like, it was all these extra time, but I was doing it because it was fun. And what I noticed over the last year and a half, as I was working on all my performance and all this other stuff, was that in mastering the other things, like the fun part went away. The content wasn't fun for me. The performance wasn't fun for me. And so it wasn't fun for the audience. Mm. And I got to a point where it was just like, it was so exhausting for me to speak. Like I didn't want to, cause it wasn't fun. I'm like, God, well, why am I doing this? It's not fun. Yeah. My consulting is like fine. Like I can survive just on consulting, but there was a part of me that does like to speak. But I was like, well, how do I fix this? And so this year has really been the year of getting the fun back. And I don't mean to be a broken record with this, but I really went back and said, well, what made Weight Watchers fun? Like, why was that so much fun? And I realized it was because I had gotten to a point of comfort with these topics that I never repeated a meeting twice. Like there were definitely leaders who would be like, oh, well, this is the topic. This is the meeting where I do X. And I never did that. It was like a point of pride for me. It was a constant challenge. Like, okay, well, great. Here comes activity again. What are we going to do this time? But by having to figure out a new way to do it every time, it did a couple of things. One, it made sure that I knew, I mean, I had to know these topics inside and out, any way you could look at them, push them, pull them, stretch them, shrink them. But it also meant that on the spur of the moment, I could change course, but still be talking about something in a way that I was familiar with and comfortable with, just because I'd spent so much time researching it and thinking about it and talking it through in one way or another somewhere else.
So you weren't rehearsed. You were just a natural at it after doing it so many times in so many different ways.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it was a different kind of rehearsal. It was, you know, I wouldn't say that I won't ever say don't rehearse, because I completely believe that rehearsal is the key to a masterful performance. But I think rehearsal takes many forms. And so a lot of times when I'm talking to clients and they're like, oh, I don't love to rehearse. I'm like, well, I still believe that running through your content as you intend to do it at least several times is always good, just so that something that works well on paper doesn't always work well when you speak it. But the other thing I say to people is that rehearsal, I rehearse every time I record a video every week. You know, I do a weekly video podcast, and they're always 8 minutes or less. I got to tell you, so many of those little bits have ended up in talks because by recording the video, I figured out the best way to say something. And now that's the way I say it. I rehearse by having these conversations with my clients. So, you know, a topic will come up, a question will come, or a question continues to come up. And I'll keep experimenting as I'm working with them on what's the best way to explain this. Okay, what would be a good, better example of this? What's another way to explain it? Until eventually what happens is, you know, what ends up in my talks is very well rehearsed, but it's because it's the way I've come to explain something over time after lots and lots of trial and error and figuring out what works with actual people. And there's always a point where I'm trying to figure it out myself first. Like even my videos, I'll sit and I'll write out my red thread statements, as I call them. I don't script those videos, but I know the points that I'm trying to hit and in what order. And I have done it in as little as one take and as many as 72. Like, just the right combination. Though I'll have to tell you that most recently I've gotten better and better about going, you know what, that one's close enough. And I've shrunk down the number of takes per video.
It sounds like you have fun when you're taking these videos, even if it's just you by yourself, right?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah, so I apologize for any of my neighbors who may occasionally hear a loudly voiced curse word of one sort or another. Because sometimes you'll be like, hey, yeah, I'm having fun because I'm figuring it out. And I'll be like, and in the middle of this great thing. And then all of a sudden, I will just come to a point where I stumble over what I'm saying so badly that I can't recover it. Like, I don't try to edit out my occasional stumbles. I'm human. I don't want people to think that they're totally scripted. I do get that question. People are like, do you script those? And it's like, no. But there are certain times where I just absolutely muff it. And I'm just like, ah! And there's a loudly voiced curse word that erupts from the apartment. Because usually it's like in the last 2 seconds of the video after I've gotten this like perfect arc. And I'm like, dang it. I'm like, that's not what I wanted. But I do have fun. So that's what I've been trying to do this year, is get the fun on stage too. And I started back with the content. Like, how do I know what I'm trying to say, just like my videos. My videos taught me a lot about this too. I know what I'm trying to say. I have worked out a couple different ways to say it. I've worked out what feels like by and large the best way to say it, though a word will be different here or there from time to time. But then I really started to figure out, well, how do I get it to feel more like a Weight Watcher meeting to me? And that meant asking a lot more questions and honestly bringing a lot more of my personal stories in that I just, for a lot of time, I was kind of uncomfortable talking about them. because I didn't immediately see how to make them relevant to what I was talking about. But so often now what I'm talking about is best illustrated because sometimes these examples from my Weight Watcher meetings were just so crystal clear that it's a great way to articulate something. And you know, most people who see me now, it's always a surprise for them that I used to weigh 50 pounds more. So that already gets people into a change of state about me. But it's been really interesting to kind of slowly each year kind of figure out what's the next thing, what's the next piece that I'm trying to bring into my speaking. And in certain ways, this year is about actually returning to where I started, but with the benefit of all that I've learned in between.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think personal stories are so critically important. It humanizes you. It builds relatedness with the audience, and they feel like they can connect and take that journey with you. They're listening with, instead of a critical voice thinking, so what? They're thinking to themselves, me too. I had a problem where I wasn't 50 pounds overweight, but I did not look the way I wanted to look. And I can totally relate to you on that level. So yeah. In fact, the reason why I started my podcast has a large thing to do with the way I used to look. About 20 years older than I actually was. And it was all kind of unconscious that I let myself go in that way. But then people see the before photo and like, holy cow, Stefan, I can't believe you used to look like that. They would be shocked. And do you share your before photo of when you were 50 pounds overweight?
I do, because it's one of those things that people don't believe me unless I show them.
Yeah.
And I think that's it. It's an important aspect of change of state. I mean, I know that I can just describe that for people, but usually what they say is I can't even imagine. So it's useful to have I do have two before pictures that I put up on a slide if that's the case, and I put them up just so that people can see it.
Yeah.
And it's funny, again, I go back and they're like, well, of course that makes this case, because I knew that even from Weight Watchers. Like if I didn't say within the first few minutes of the meeting why I had credibility to stand there, then new members walking in would be like, well, who's this skinny thing, Doug? You know, I mean, I knew it because I could see it on their face. And I would actually call it out. You know, I'd be like, I know, you're saying to yourself, like, what's this, you know, skinny bee doing up there, like talking about this? Well, let me tell you. And they love the fact that I just went right after what was in their head. And, you know, that was it. And then once that was dispensed with, and then they knew I was kind of had been in there with them. And I think what I don't love is when people use personal stories manipulatively, meaning because they think just because it makes them relatable. Because I've seen, and I see this working with clients, and I see it particularly with people who are wanting to put together TEDx and TEDx style talks. They have this image in their head that they're always anchored in some kind of like deep, wrenching personal story. And so what I've seen a little too often is someone tells this deep, wrenching personal story, and then it's completely unrelated to the point that they're trying to make. And it's kind of like, well, why didn't you say that? So, you know, a thing that I'm really ruthless about is there has to be a legitimate reason why that story is in there. And if it's not a legitimate reason why it's in there, I personally am not going to put it in there. So, for example, I have a story that I know people really like of mine and they find it really powerful, but it really hasn't been until recently it has truly had a reason to be in the talk. And that is that I was running the Boston Marathon the year that it got bombed. And that's actually less interesting to me and seems to be less interesting to people than the fact that 2 weeks after that, I put my number back on and finished it by myself. And, you know, it's actually that piece of it that I went back and finished it by myself that now has a reason to exist in at least one of the talks that I give, because, of, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about what makes ideas irresistible. As I said before, how do you overcome resistance to making an action that you want or need to make? Going back and finishing that race, even though it was without any of the glory that should have been there if the bombing hadn't happened. It's an illustration of that. How did I move through the anger and the guilt of not finishing and being angry about not finishing and then being guilty about being angry because I wasn't hurt. You know, I was too dang slow. It's like I was 5.5 miles back. But I think that stories have to serve a very specific purpose. Either they have to be tied to what you say.
Yeah.
Because otherwise people will enjoy them. They might feel inspired by them, but then you almost waste the power of them because they're, if you can tie them to the point that you're trying to make, then they just carry this additional, their own momentum behind them. So why not harness that towards your point?
Yeah. So I guess there are two approaches to sharing your big kind of signature story around losing 50 pounds, or for me, essentially going back in time like Benjamin Button, getting younger. Have you seen my before photo?
I haven't. Now I'm really curious.
Oh my God.
I want to see it.
You can go to optimizedgeek.com and click on the about page. Yeah, it'll blow your mind.
All right. That's awesome.
So not every talk that I do, and I speak a lot. I've done keynotes recently. I do like lots of panel sessions and workshops and things like that. And not everyone is appropriate for me to share my before photo. Most of them are not, actually. I'm teaching something about some aspect of SEO and how to get Google to bend to your will sort of thing. And it's not really appropriate for me to share that before and any kind of story around that, because it's not relevant and it won't help them. So I'm totally on board with what you're saying. And I used to shy away from sharing my before photo and my story because I was embarrassed. And I was thinking like, oh, I really don't love that when you Google my name, some old versions of me are showing up in the images results on the first page. Oh, I wish I could get rid of that. Oh, actually, no, I know a few things about SEO. I think it actually pushed that off onto off of page one. And then I'm thinking, no, I probably should just leave it, because this is part of my story. It's part of who I am. And it's part of the value that I bring into the world, is like being that vulnerable and open. I was so vulnerable that 4 weeks ago, I did stem cell therapy. So one of my episodes on the show was with an amazing stem cell doctor, Dr. Harry Adelson, who keynoted at the last Bulletproof conference. So my wife and I go to his clinic in Park City, Utah about a month ago, and we get the full Monty, like the whole procedure, like the whole thing, and including I got the P shot and my wife got the O shot. So you can guess what the letter P stands for if you think about it. If it's for men only, and then the female version is the O shot. So we got stem cells injected everywhere. Mm. Places that hurt, places that didn't hurt, places that didn't really need it because they were awesome already. It's a really amazing experience. And I was afraid of needles. So I'm like, just put me out for the whole thing. I don't want to be awake for the procedure. Dave Asprey, the Bulletproof Coffee guy, another past guest on the show, he was doing a Facebook Live completely awake during the procedure while they're harvesting stem cells from his bone marrow and from his fat. And he actually passed out a few times during the Facebook Live, and you know, just temporarily for a few seconds, and then he's back. But yeah, I'm like, put me out for this. But you know, the first thing I did as soon as I woke up, within like 5 seconds, where's my phone? I want to take a video and I want to share. And I was covered like in like a bloody mess on my face, because they take PRP, platelet-rich plasma, from your blood, as well as stem cells, which they had harvested from my fat and my bone marrow. And that was microneedle injected into my face. So I looked like, I don't know, somebody had dragged my face along a freeway for a while. And I'm like, I don't care. I'm just going to do a video. And my wife was there with me, and she had gone through the procedure a couple hours earlier, and she looked pretty similar to that. But I had just woken up. And I'm doing a Facebook video sharing my experience with people. Even just like a couple years ago, I would not have done that. So having that kind of vulnerability and openness is so critical. So you build that relatedness. So you actually impact people and take them on that journey. So you really do change their lives.
Yeah, it's, some of us are wired in such a way that it's like, it's no question. You're like, sure, I'll tell you everything. And others of us are wired in a way where it's just, okay, I need to see the reason why it's going to be useful. But once I see enough that it's this useful to talk about this piece, then okay, yeah, I get it. And as I said, as long as it's tied to the greater purpose, not of making Lee look good, that's not enough of a reason for me. It's not about like, hey, look at what you did. It's actually, it needs to serve the idea. It needs to serve the point. And if it does that, then that for me is that's the reason to include it.
Yeah. And what you said there about looking good, and also conversely, not looking bad.
Yeah.
That just needs to be dropped from the motivations for, I think, all of our listeners when they're doing, whether it's a Facebook Live or it's a speech on a stage or it's a TV appearance or just running your own little meeting and having a handful of people in a room. Just get rid of that drive, that ego drive to look good or to not look bad, because that doesn't serve anybody, including yourself.
Right. And that's where my check your dignity at the door piece came in.
Yeah, that's great.
That was my, you know, that was my reminder to myself, like, just don't try so hard. Just being fully connected and fully present was just always, it ended up being more useful. And so, you know, when I, you know, over the last 2 years, I was really trying to work on my speaking, it became a source of great frustration for me. Like, why couldn't I reconnect with that? I said to multiple people, like, why, this was so easy for me in the Weight Watcher room. What's different about when I get up on stage? Like, why is that not translating in my own head? Because it wasn't that I was doing it and it wasn't connecting. It was like, I just wasn't doing it. And so that's when I took a hard look at what I was doing. I was like, you know what? It's because I'm not preparing the content the same way. Because I very much believe that you have to, you know, the only way out is through. And I won't tell somebody to do something. I won't advise somebody to do something if I haven't tried it myself. Like, I'm a lifelong believer in what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So it's like, if I'm not willing to do it, if I'm not willing to try it, I'm not going to tell you to do it. And I think it's best that if I've done it, then I'm in a better position to help you understand like what that experience can be like. So, which is why I wanted to kind of say, well, okay, well, I'm going to try different ways to put keynotes together in addition to my own working out for myself, what's the process that really works for me and what works for my clients and the TEDx speakers. And the one thing that I wasn't doing was mimicking what I knew from 13 years of speaking worked really well, which was not having it so tightly scripted on paper first and then getting it on my feet, but actually getting the words solid around the concepts. And then if I needed to, then committing that after the fact to a script so that it became something I could go back and reference. So it's just really interesting to me that this is kind of a process of rediscovery and a reconnection with what works and being willing to say, okay, I see the value in some of these other approaches to putting something together. But the fiber of my, I've got 13 years of muscle memory around presenting a certain way. And I'm sure if I spent 13 years, you know, with fully scripted talks that I rehearsed to a fairly well as scripted, they would be equally comfortable to me, maybe. But I think I would miss the fun, frankly, of kind of not knowing exactly what the audience is going to say in response and being able to play in the moment with what somebody says or does. Being able to have that level of flexibility and ability to improv in the moment. Because when I write my talks, I am not funny. I'm just not. But those moments where I can play, those moments of improv in between those pieces that I know really well, that's when I'm actually funny. But it was never something I could capture. And that was frustrating to me too. I'm like, well, why can't I be funny on stage? It's because I was trying to script every moment. And don't get me wrong, knowing what you're saying and finding the best way to say it is absolutely key. But the real eye-opening thing for me is that there needs to be more than one way to get there for people and people who work with speakers. So if you've got listeners or thinking about what's a good approach for them, I would highly recommend the best coaches are the ones that can change their approach to suit you, that have multiple ways of getting to the same conclusion. And I'm thankful that I work with people who were able to do that, but this blowing it back up from the content up was definitely me going back and saying, I want to make this feel like it did back in the meeting room, back when I was a Weight Watcher leader.
And so when you're working with your clients or speakers that are speaking at TEDx Cambridge that you oversee, you're incorporating stuff that you've learned that works, and you also incorporate, or you don't squash their own personal style. You let them kind of work within a certain framework. Mm. So they're able to be funny if they're funny in the moment, but they're not if it's all scripted, or if they have a certain way of showing up on stage that's a little unusual in the way they stand or the way that they interact with the audience or whatever, but it works. You've developed this framework that it works for everybody, right? The red thread.
So far it is. Yeah.
Let's talk about the red thread. So first of all, how did you said earlier that you want to teach stuff that you've done yourself and that you found works. So the red thread was something that you came up with yourself through trial and error, through your Weight Watchers experience. Like how did this come about?
That's a yes to all of it. So, you know, it came about first and foremost with TEDx Cambridge. And while I retired from my executive producer role at the end of last year after the last event, that absolutely is where it started, because I was in a position where I had just started my own business. I'd already had a couple of years at TEDx Cambridge under my belt, but I started my own business and I was in a position where I gave myself the challenge of coming up with a new way of getting people to the best version of their idea and a narrative for the talk that felt like a story, even if it wasn't one, that didn't use anybody else's IP. I wanted to create something from whole cloth. And I had, at this point, now 2 years ago, I had 20 years of marketing and brand strategy and message strategy under my belt. I had about 15 years as a speaker under my belt. I already had 2 years as a TEDx executive producer, and I also had those 13 years of Weight Watchers. And so the process to come up with the red thread was really, ultimately, at the highest level, it was me trying to reverse engineer what I had learned by osmosis as a Weight Watcher leader that I then turned, and then I took what worked in the meeting room and I applied that to my marketing jobs. I just kind of had this developed over time, this innate sense of that messages worked when they had certain stuff in them, but I hadn't really figured out what those things were. And it turns out that in the research to figure out how to be a better storyteller, remember that was the thing that was on my list a couple of years ago, I took this deep dive into story structure and storyboarding as, you know, novel writers, TV writers and film writers do it. And I had some inside help, of course, because my sister happens to be, I don't know if we mentioned this last time you and I spoke, my sister happens to be now an Emmy-winning screenwriter and Writers Guild of America award winner, a screenwriter.
Wow.
She's awesome. She's one of the writers and producers of The Handmaid's Tale. So, and has done all sorts of other writing credits, but that's what the awards came from. And so I was trying to figure out, well, okay, story structure. I've been reading about it for years. Of course, Nancy Duarte does a wonderful job talking about it. But my experience in business was that typical story structure, rising action, following action, calling to the quest, you know, the hero and the mentor and all this, which is way too freaking complicated for most business people, right? You would start to talk to them about these things and it would glaze over. And the other thing that was really frustrating to me was just because you know the elements of a story didn't mean that you knew how to build one. And so this is a puzzle that I wanted to fix, because I wanted to fix it because I wanted to be a better storyteller. But I also knew I needed to do it because I needed my TEDx speakers to be better storytellers too. And so I started playing around with, okay, well, rather than try to focus on what do you put in each of the acts of a classic story structure, you know, act one, setup, act two, conflict, act three, resolution, which is where most advice starts. I said, well, maybe it will become clear what I should put into the acts if I actually focus more on what the endpoints of those acts are. Like, so setup, well, what is the setup about? Where does someone start and where do you get to as you break into act two? And so I was like, okay, well, how does that relate back to business? How does that relate back to what I did in the Weight Watcher meeting room? And I was like, oh, I know. I know what would get somebody to start on a journey is that if they knew at the end of it, they would get something that they really wanted. So I was like, if there's an irresistible outcome, then that would get them to at least start. This is something I'd seen over and over again in the meeting room. I mean, obviously in the meeting room, like, people want to lose weight. There's a pretty universal goal there. So that was obvious. But in my marketing jobs, I'd seen the same thing. So companies would want to differentiate, or they wanted to raise donations, or they wanted to do X, Y, or Z. So there was a thing that they wanted. And so that was the beginning of act one, right? And so I didn't have to really actually figure out what went in the middle yet. I just need to figure out, well, where did act one need to end? Well, in classic story structure, act one ends with the introduction of a problem. And so I started to think back to marketing and Weight Watchers and my own experience. I was like, well, it's not just any problem, though. It's not a problem that people already know about, because back to Weight Watchers, plenty of people know what's getting in their way of not achieving their weight loss goals, if that's something in their mind. So it's not the awareness of the problem that's the key. Like, there actually has to be a specific kind of problem that gets in the way. And so I was like, okay, well, if I can identify what that specific kind of problem is, then we've got something. And I knew that by, you know, I could ask anyone, all right, well, tell me what your audience wants that your message can help them get. And most people can answer that question. And then I could say, well, all right, now tell me about what's getting in their way. Now tell me what they think is getting in their way. But then here's the next blank I wanted them to fill. What do you really think is getting in the way? What is the perspective that they have that's blinding them to the path that you see towards getting to that goal? And so that was the second blank. It's the thing I call the problem, because that's how we got into Act Two. Now, Act Two, of course, is all about the conflict, and there's a midpoint and all of this. And there's this point in Act Two of storytelling structure where there is something, you know, they call it the point of no return. It's the climax, whatever. It's the point at which the hero of the story can't turn back, for one reason or another, or there's a moment where they decide whether or not that's it or not. And so I was like, okay, well, did that validate in my own experience what I had seen when trying to move people along in a message, whether that was a meeting room or a marketing? And I was like, yeah, there were times when there would be this one piece of information that when delivered, all of a sudden now they move themselves to the next step. They move themselves to doing something different. So it's like, okay, so this clearly to me, I said, that's got to be the third blank that we have to fill. We have to fill the equivalent of the midpoint, the thing that people can't unhear. And so I started to call this the idea, some neutral piece of information, some incontrovertible truth that made this problem that we'd introduced impossible to ignore, but also, if we didn't do anything about the problem, would put the goal in jeopardy, right? So I was like, okay, goal, problem, idea. Interesting. Okay. So now I've got three blanks that I think that I can get people to answer fairly easily to fill in. And by the way, it also, once I knew what those things were, it started to be pretty clear. Well, how do you fill in the space in between them? Because then you're just asking yourself, well, how do I get someone from the goal to the problem? And how do I get them from the problem to the idea? And then the cool thing was, of course, that from the idea, the midpoint, the thing that would break into Act Three, the thing that would take it to the resolution is, well, what's the thing that they're going to do different? What's the thing that they decided to do or need to decide to do differently? That created the fourth blank for people to fill in. And that's what I referred to as the change. So what's the high level shift in thinking that needs to happen in order for someone to achieve that goal, resolve that problem of perspective, but still stay true to that idea that's kind of at the core of it all? And that was the change. And then the fifth thing was like, well, what are the specific actions that people would take? And that's not even really a, you know, that's just mostly because, and particularly in talks, and you and I talked about this in our previous podcast together, when someone's got, you know, 7 steps to SEO success, well, that's great. Those are the actions, but we have to figure out overall what's the big shift that they're doing. So once I reverse engineered my own experience against story structure and knowing what, based on my experience, people actually couldn't answer as far as questions go, I realized I had this set of concepts that, if I could get people to answer those questions, I had accomplished like several things simultaneously, which was awesome. I had probably first and foremost really pulled apart the conditions that created the idea for somebody in the first place. We had basically been able to figure out what are these concepts that actually create the conditions for agreement. And I think I said before, you can't tell someone to change, but you can create the conditions for change. And I realized that all these things that I had come up with, I knew that they did that because I also knew from the research that I had done all my years in both Weight Watcher Leader and marketing when it comes to what makes people act and motivation and all this other stuff, that it was relying on known science about how the brain works to get people to flip how they're thinking about something. And so basically after that, it was just a matter of going, well, I wonder if this works like this. And then I started using it with the TEDx speakers because that was all pro bono. I wasn't getting paid to do that. So it turned into my lab. I was like, let's see how this works. And it worked like a freaking charm. And then the free prize inside was because these blanks were based on story structure. If people filled in those statements and they put those statements in that order in the course of the talk, they also had this high level outline for the talk that felt like a story. So starting about 2 years ago, it was really just a process of getting clearer and clearer and clearer about how to make it easier and easier and easier for people to fill in those blanks. And then the last thing I needed to do was name the damn thing. And so that's where the red thread came in. It was a really long explanation, but that's the history of it.
That's great. And you taught us a lot about what the red thread is and how the framework works and why it works and why you'd want to use it. So it's like a story arc. There's the goal, there's the problem, there's the idea, the change, and the action that the person would need to take in order to achieve their outcome that they're after. And a lot of times people don't recognize the true problem. So you can articulate the problem in that story arc or in the red thread in a way that gives them an aha or some sort of insight, because there's the spoken problem,
yep,
the obvious problem, but there's also the unspoken problem that they don't want to tell you about. Like, for example, with me and why I looked so old for my age back in, you know, a decade ago, I was married to a woman who was 16 years older than me. And unconsciously, I was letting myself go and looking older because I didn't, like, my fear was that I would get mistaken for her son. And that really was, I think, the unconscious impetus for me to look older. And so that's the unspoken problem. I don't volunteer that information usually. I mean, we're divorced now and I'm happily married to my soulmate now, but wow, what an embarrassing thing to share. Like, yeah, I was married to somebody 16 years older than me. That's fine for a woman to be married to a man 16 years older, but culturally it's kind of taboo for a man to be married to a woman 16 years older than him. So, you know, whatever. I got over my fear and discomfort, I guess, with sharing that. So that's the unspoken problem that I had. And the spoken problem, that's easy. You know, I'm just letting myself go. Back in the day, I looked older than my age. And then the unspoken problem. But then there's the unknown problem, which I guess actually I did not at the time realize that that's why I was letting myself go, or yeah, like looking the way that I did, was because of that fear.
And that's one of those places where, as a speaker, this is what I love that you just said that, because this is where I love to just home in on with speakers to say, see, this is the reason why we're often unintentionally not successful with getting our ideas across, is that we forget that we had these little realizations all the way along. We think that a great idea is found, but great ideas are built. They're built little piece by piece by piece. And the moment where we think we, quote unquote, have an idea is simply the moment where the last piece falls into place. And each of us can think about this. And I'm curious if this resonates for you with the change that you made in your life. If you think about the hardest change you've ever made in your life, whatever that was, maybe it was the ending of a relationship or beginning one, or maybe it was a change in health or what, you know, starting a business, whatever it might have been. Everybody I've talked to so far has said to me that, of course, it was a lot of work, but there was one moment when suddenly the decision to act became easy, or at the very least, when not acting became harder than acting. And that moment is what I'm obsessed with. And like, what is it that creates that moment? And what I realized is that this goal, this problem, this idea, that's this magic combination that when they're set up just the right way, they create this tension that pop you over into a change. And as speakers, because we forget that steps happen, we try just to share the idea as a complete thing. We don't realize that we actually have to give people the pieces so that they can put it back together in their own heads and come up with the same conclusion. But this is where we have an advantage, though, because now you may not have thought about it in that way yet, but because now you've come to that conclusion already, you can go back and say, huh, well, I know what the, now looking back on it, I could say that I thought it was X, but now I can see it was because I had, and I call this the, you know, a problem of incomplete perspective, that you were focused more on let's say, matching your partner than matching yourself, right? Mm-hmm. With what, you know, so that was this, you know, that's a way for you as this already changed person to go back and put a name on the problem of perspective that you had. And then there was probably some core fundamental belief that you have, Stefan, about being true to yourself or happiness or the way the insides match outsides or whatever. There's some core fundamental belief to you that once you put that against, consciously or not, put it against that problem of perspective, made it impossible for you to continue to say, well, wait a minute, why am I matching my partner when I believe this? So I've got to do something that's true to me. That's where we have this advantage as speakers and people with ideas, is that you actually, because you have reached this point, we can turn that curse of knowledge into a blessing, because you can, now that you know what the elements are, you can take this now informed perspective on, how do I describe this in its most powerful way to somebody else so they understand exactly what that was? And then by doing that, you can recreate the conditions for people in a very short amount of time that allowed you to have that idea, that come to that conclusion in the first place. So, you know, it took you however many years to get all the pieces in place, but well articulated, you may still need to support it, but you can lay the groundwork for that shift for someone in a minute or less just by saying, let's say that you want to, you know, live a long, happy life, but the problem is if you're matching your partner rather than yourself, well, there's a problem there. Why? Because you are the only one that can live your life, right? So that's going to create some kind of gap, which means that you're going to want to change. And what is that change? Okay, now as a speaker, you can say, and these are the actions you can take. I mean, I know you don't speak on that, Stefan, but just as an example.
That is so cool. I love how you just kind of unfolded that whole story into something that's relevant to everybody. That's so powerful. And you connected the dots. I mean, that's where I know the name, the Red Thread, comes from. But do you want to quickly share for our listeners who aren't familiar with the origins of the name?
Sure. The more I work on it, the more that I realize that I kind of stumbled into a perfect name for it. So the Red Thread is used as a colloquialism in a fair amount of Europe to mean the through line, the thing that makes things make sense. And it comes from the Greek myth of Theseus and the Minotaur. And the Red Thread is actually the way that Theseus traced his path to the Minotaur, the monster that he had to slay in this labyrinth, so that he could retrace his path on the way out. So for me, the Red Thread method, as I've developed, does very much the same thing. It allows you to kind of follow the path back to, you know, you've already slayed the monster. That's the thing that you're talking about. And you're trying to teach other people either how to do it or why it's important to slay the same monster. But in order to do that, you actually follow that same path. And that is the reason why it's called the Red Thread.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And when you were saying earlier that so you're obsessed with finding out that one moment where the shift came, where the point of leverage, or what's another word for it?
Well, it's just like, it's when the hard thing becomes easy, not that it becomes without work, but it's just, you know, it's just that flip switches, that switch flips. There we go. Cool.
Yeah. So it was for me, the catalyst for all of these changes that I made to do my life reboot and look the way I do now versus the way I did a decade ago. It was a firewalk. It was literally a firewalk, walking on 2,000 degree hot coals at a Tony Robbins event called mm-hmm. Unleash the Power Within. That was the moment. When you were describing, like, you're obsessed with finding that moment,
yeah,
I knew exactly that moment that you were talking about in my story. It was that 10 seconds or 20 seconds when I walked on the hot coals and I didn't get in my bare feet.
Yeah.
I didn't get burned. I didn't get blisters or anything. And I'm like, wow, if I can do this, I can do anything. I had been paralyzed by fear. I wanted for years to get LASIK so that I didn't have to wear glasses anymore. 2 weeks later, boom, I had LASIK.
Yeah, right. I mean, and that's the thing I saw over and over again, particularly in the meeting room at Weight Watchers, is that there was usually something that flipped, like just there was this thing that suddenly, like, all the tumblers in the lock fell into place. And once that happened, there was no stopping some people from getting to that point. And it's the same thing that you just described, that whenever I ask someone about the hardest change they ever made, there's always this moment. And sometimes it's wonderfully dramatic like that. I mean, for me, it was watching Oprah and Sarah Ferguson, the Duchess of York, attempt to make chocolate chip scones on TV. Like, that was the one, that was the moment where I'm like, I'm going to go finally do something about my weight. That's a whole other story. But literally it was. It was like, you know, watching that make it, because all of a sudden it made me realize like, oh, wait a minute. I can do this with the foods I love instead of what I've been doing, which is trying to cut everything out. And then I was like, ah, all right. Well, now at that point, all reasonable barriers are removed. And even unreasonable barriers are removed, as you say, like it's the fear and whatever. But that moment where you said to yourself, and you know, I was going to ask you, like, what did that teach you? It taught you that it was possible to do something you didn't think was possible. And as soon as that happened, then it was impossible for you to maintain this previously held perspective about what you could or couldn't do. You just couldn't do it. You're like, it's just not possible for me. And so essentially what we're doing, what the red thread does, the psychological science behind it is that, you know, a lot of times we hear about cognitive dissonance as a bad thing, that we don't like cognitive dissonance. But in fact, you can harness cognitive dissonance. And that's, of course, where you can't hold two things to be true simultaneously in your head. One of them always gives. I like to say it this way, that when two truths fight, only one lives. You can't stand it. Like, something will always change. And what the red thread does essentially is creates a condition in which something is mentally, something in your perspective is forced to change. If you continue to want the goal that the speaker has put out for you, or if you're just talking about your internal resistance, if you decide you still want to lose weight or you still want to achieve this thing, if you haven't decided to unwant that thing, and if you have anchored it into a belief, some incontrovertible truth that you're not going to suddenly be unconvinced that you can't do anything. I mean, you just walked on freaking coals. You're not going to suddenly go back and say, well, no, actually, that didn't happen. You're not going to unbelieve something you believe. And you're not going to unwant something that you want most of the time, which means all we have to do is set up an understanding for people where something they want and something they believe are both put in jeopardy by how they're looking at the world, by that perspective that is incomplete and probably invisible to them. Because it's the way they've just been living their life to date. Like, you didn't even realize that you were operating in such a way that you were kind of matching your partner. But at this moment, this other thing happened. You're like, wait a minute. I am a separate and distinct person that is capable of other things. Why am I not doing those things? And all of a sudden it just moves. So it's really about, at its heart, it's about harnessing cognitive dissonance as an agent for change, whether for yourself to figure out how to make yourself do something that you've been resistant to, or is it as an agent for change if you have a message you're trying to spread and you're trying to create the conditions for agreement for that idea. Mm,
that's awesome. And when you were describing this moment of shift, I was thinking, you know, it's like a permanent shift. Mm-hmm. It's a realization. It's a shift in identity. So now the person I am after the fire walk can go get stem cell therapy and get all bloody and everything and have no problem being on camera doing a Facebook video right afterwards. That person is part of who I am. That's not somebody I would have been a decade ago. There's no way I would have even gone to get stem cell therapy or had my stem cells harvested back, you know, a decade ago. So this is all very exciting. And I'm inspired to create a talk all about this shift that I had in my life, even though, it's not something that I would normally speak about. I'd speak about SEO and online marketing and so forth in a professional environment. I think this would be a really good talk for me to work on.
I'd love to see that talk. I think it's, you know, back to the red thread. I think that there are, when we have figured out how to slay a particular monster, there are still other people still trying to fight that battle. And I think that for many of us as speakers, or just people who like to help other people, you know, we're compelled to help other people find the best and least painful path to that. And we know we can't spare people everything. But what I just found over and over and over again, and back to where we started, the lessons I learned in the Weight Watcher meeting room were that the easier I could make the mental shift, then the easier it was for people to be willing to do the hard work that would follow. Because once you change, and I think a lot of times what we try to do is we try to change what people see. So we try to put a new idea in front of them. But the real key is that we have to change how they see. Because if you change how they see, then the world around them changes as a result. Then they start to see totally different things. I mean, we create the world we think we see. So if we can figure out how to change how people see, Well, then you've potentially changed everything for them.
Yeah. So true. So true. All right. So we are out of time. This was a lot of fun. And I do want to encourage listeners to listen to the episode that we did over on Marketing Speak, because we go into why talks, how talks, and what now talks.
Yep.
Those are the keynotes and workshops and regular sessions, breakout sessions. That's fascinating. We talked about how to do a TEDx talk, how to get on a TEDx stage, talked about how to be more strategic or tactical as needed in your talks. It was a great episode as well. And yeah, so listeners, definitely check out that episode. The last thing I want to leave our listeners with is, how can they work with you? Because you are amazing at training speakers and wannabe speakers to become amazing world-class speakers. So how would they find you?
Sure. The easiest place to find me is tamsinwebster.com. If they're specifically interested in the kinds of consulting I do and those various options, that's at tamsinwebster.com/consulting. That'll give you all the different formats. So usually most people start with working with me just to figure out what that red thread is for them or for their idea. And from there, we take a modular approach. We can do as much or as little after that as you need. But the red thread is everything. It's what gives rise to all the other stuff that we always look for. It's what gives rise to the brand. It's what gives rise to the message. And you find that, and you find the thing that makes you make sense. And I think that's pretty powerful.
Yes, it is. And thank you so much, Tamsin. Thank you, listeners. We will catch you on the next episode of The Optimized Geek. In the meantime, be sure to go to optimizedgeek.com for the show notes for this episode with links to various resources that we talked about. Also, the checklist, which is amazingly awesome. It's a free PDF download that are action steps that you can take to up your game in terms of, in this case, your speaking ability and stage presence. So we'll catch you on the next episode of The Optimized Geek. This is your host, Stefan Spencer, signing off.
Thanks for listening to The Optimized Geek. Your host has been Stefan Spencer, whose own transformation is chronicled in the upcoming book of the same title. Stefan is a 3-time author, professional speaker, and leading expert on SEO and online marketing. Remember, true happiness comes as a result not of outside circumstances, but of your own actions and attitudes. Life happens for us, not to us. Subscribe for groundbreaking insights, inspiration, strategies, technologies, and distinctions that will facilitate your own personal transformation. Simply visit www.optimizedgeek.com and please review us on iTunes. Until next time.